Welcome to
Naming It, where we discuss pop culture, current events, and how they relate to the way that we live our lives, all through the lens of two black psychologists.
Naming It is dedicated to acknowledging the elephant in the room, validating the lived experience of people of color. Coming to you from the Bay Area, California, we thank you for joining us.
I'm Dr. Bedford Palmer.
And I'm Dr. Lamisha Hill. Music on Naming It is provided by Lee England Jr., the soul violinist. Good morning, evening, afternoon.
Yep.
Welcome to Naming It.
Welcome to Naming It, y'all.
Episode 41.
41. That sounds like a song. Like there's like a song that says that in there. Like 41. I don't know.
I mean, I think that we were really close to the E-40 before. So maybe we missed. Shout out to E-40 on episode 40.
Why would we shout out E-40?
It's from the Bay.
Oh, okay. Is he going to come on the show?
Hey, he might.
Come on the show, bro.
He might.
What's up, y'all? What's going on? We back. It's the end of October.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, we're getting close to November and then December and...
Holiday season. Is upon us.
Yeah.
But before we get to do that fun Halloween spooky thing... Did you get into Halloween? Did you decorate?
No. Kids don't come.
We've talked about this before, I think.
Yes, it's painful. It's irritating. I'm so sad about that. I am a homeowner with no children to come for the holiday.
Nobody's going to ring that doorbell.
Because they go to Piedmont and they go to Alameda for the big candy. Like, yo, don't let them gentrify and colonize your mind. Stay in your own neighborhood and get candy from the people who are willing to give candy in your neighborhood, yo.
Can I come ring your doorbell?
You're an adult. What
if I want some candy?
Go to the store.
It's harsh.
I'm sorry. It's a harsh world. what? You got your check-ins?
What's going on? I sure do. Yeah, y'all. How you been? It's been a minute. What did I want to share with the group today? I'm excited because I'll be going to a really fun event this evening in San Francisco for the Museum of African Diaspora. They're having their annual gala event. And thanks to my boss, shout out to Dr. Navarro for hooking me up with a ticket.
Yeah, I saw the advertisement for that. I was about to say.
Sold out.
Well, sold out, but they're like, that's a lot of, I don't want to get into your business, yo.
It's not my business. It was a gift.
Okay. Well, nice.
It was a gift. I'm Have just going to be excited to be there. I'll report back all the wonderful.
Bougie-ness.
Why you got to go there, Bedford? Why you got to go there? Just because I get to do, you know, people going to be dressed up, looking good, looking clean. Okay. Enjoying themselves and some music.
I know, I know you like the cotillion stuff, and
I've never had a cotillion. Know,
the white gloves and
I didn't do all that.
You know, all that stuff. I mean, I'm saying,
okay. You know, you're affiliated with some highfalutin organizations as well. They call you in. You affiliated it yourself.
I don't know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I ain't talking about going to the Museum of African American art and modern art. What does MOAD stand for, actually?
The Museum of the African Diaspora.
Yeah. It's dope, actually. I wanted to go there, but it is hella expensive. But, yeah. So, please take selfies and
I will.
Do pictures.
I'll bring Naming It with me.
Yo, bring some buttons and some cards. We can get some interviews from these folks. Can we get some donations? I mean...
I will hustle for the podcast.
Technically, we are modern art. In the diaspora.
You're right about that. This is another form of art and expression.
Just saying.
I will bring Naming It. Naming It will have a couple Instagram selfies with the button.
Okay, cool.
So, maybe she get like a bobblehead or something. Like
yours. if you want a bobblehead.
How do we, you know, the button shows up in different spaces. That's cool. We can keep it that way.
Yeah, we can holler at the, what is it, the... No, I'm good on bobbleheads. I don't think that is a good representation.
All right, what you got going on?
So I just want to, I got a couple of shout-ins real quick. So last week, not this last week, I guess, but recently, because y'all don't really know my business like that, but like recently was my anniversary. So I just want to wish my wife a happy anniversary. We had, this is 4 years, you know, love you, baby. And I also wanted to wish a happy birthday to one of our dopest namers, Kevin Grant. So happy birthday, Kev. Hope you had a great day. I saw like Instagram with you and the kids, so I know that you were having a great day. And my last one is to iPhone X. Yeah, I'm just going to just say I want to shout out to my iPhone 10 that will arrive.
Did you really get one?
Damn straight I got one.
Why?
Are you kidding? It's the best. It's the thing. It's like Jordan's now.
Since when have you been one to be on trends and on things? Because it's the newest.
Oh, I thought you knew I was an early adopter. Yeah, that's a real thing. I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, I've been looking. I don't know what to tell you. I don't know how to.
How much is it? Can I get in your business like that?
No, you can't.
How much is this iPhone 10?
Let's just say there's multiple ways you can get one. You know, you can either buy it outright or you can pay the little thing and get the upgrade stuff. You can do what you want to do. I'm just happy that I got through the midnight crazy sale and I was able to acquire one for myself. So,
but what is so wonderful about it? What is it going to do differently? New.
It doesn't matter.
He said it's just new. That's all we need to know.
Man. Damn right. Just what makes Jordans dope? What gets a sneakerhead moving? I'm just saying.
I'm not a sneakerhead, so I wouldn't know.
Yeah. What do you collect? What are your things?
What do I collect? I don't really collect anything. What would I spend some money on?
I don't know.
Apparently. Is that what it means?
The whole millennial experience. I just buy experiences. I don't have a TV. I don't do this. I
experiences. I like things like if I can get something that's like on super sale that's like really, really expensive, but I got it for like 10% of what it costs. I'm excited about that.
It's not a sale. 10% off?
No, like 10% of its full retail value.
So 90% off.
Yeah, 90% off. If I can get it for 90% off.
Well, yeah, you can get. I almost buy junk for 90% off.
I'm not talking about junk. I'm talking about quality luxury items.
Okay. Junk.
Let's move on, y'all. Clearly, we have different values. Because you know why I have an aversion to like spending a lot of money on phones? Because when I was, golly, how old? I was probably 21, and the Motorola Razr phone just came out, and I went out and bought one, and I will never forget the person on the phone that when I was buying the phone.
You weren't 21 when the Razr came out.
Yes, I was.
No, you weren't.
Yes, I was.
You were like 16.
I was 21. I remember the day. I was in Chicago. I lived on Montrose Avenue. I lived on Montrose and Damon. What up, Chicago? I lived on Montrose and Damon, and I will never forget it because I called.
Wait, hold up. Where's Montrose and Damon?
That's on the northwest side.
Is it, that's where you lived?
Yeah. I was living in an apartment on Montrose and Damon.
Is that in Chicago or in the suburbs?
In Chicago.
Oh, okay. Just checking. I know you like to claim Chicago, but I thought you were from the burbs, y'all.
Look, you're messing up my story here. So I was on the phone with the lady trying to get my new Razr phone upgrade. And I will never forget the person said to me, ma'am, you do know that's a $500 phone or something. Maybe it was even $1,000. I don't know. I don't think it was $1,000. I think it was $500. And I'm like, you do know it's going to cost $500. And I was like, yeah, and I spent my $500, and then I lost it in a cab. And never again will I ever, ever, ever spend a whole lot of money on a phone.
Good for you. I got my iPhone. Moving on.
Someone tell him, y'all. Screen's going to crack. Something's going to happen to it.
So, stuff happens.
Okay. Well, you enjoy your iPhone.
Actually, real talk. No, I'm not even going to go there. Forget it. It's not that important. I just was happy that I got it. You don't have to rain on my parade and act all high and mighty and stuff about phones and whatnot. I just like things that I got. Can I enjoy stuff?
I will let you live.
Can I just enjoy life?
Enjoy yourself.
You know? Dang.
Balling over there.
Nah.
Can I get a phone?
Whatever. Let's not go there, director. Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Can I get a phone? Yeah.
Where you work at? Where you work at? University of what?
Like, I work for a public institution.
Yeah. I ain't saying nothing. All I'm saying is that it's public and salaries are online. So, like, you know, if you want to validate, you know.
Don't do that.
Yeah,
to
all
me.
Right. So let's just stop.
It's the Bay Area, man. It's expensive
whatever,
out here.
Whatever.
Have you been checking my salary?
No, but I know I work at a smaller salary in liberal arts school and you work at the University of. Yeah, let's stop.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
For we're you, right. Moad. Let,
yeah, let's
go
stop.
On the Moad.
I'm going to go to the Moad and you're going to get your
like
iPhone.
Pretending like your boss bought the ticket when you know you just came out of pocket. Like, pocket change.
No.
Pocket change.
I swear on everything.
Put your monocle down, homie.
Thank you
your
to the Vice
jets.
Chancellor for the invitation. I'm excited to go. Anyway. Let's get into it. What's going on.
What's going on?
Are you going to play the jams?
All right. So go ahead. Y'all do that.
What's going on?
Hey. No, no.
What's going on?
You just clip that and use that for the rest of the time.
All right. So we already referenced this, that, but the Halloween season is upon us.
Is it a season?
Yeah, it is.
It's a season.
I think so.
Autumn is a season.
Okay, well, yeah, it's not like a weather season, but
just,
in terms of like
it's just Halloween, like a
marketing.
It's a weekend.
Commercial. No, people put the decorations up for at least a month, and then
no, they don't. People
yes,
don't put
they
Halloween
do.
Up for a month.
Yeah,
who does that?
People that really, really like it.
I've seen stuff up for like.
You know how long it takes to put up all those things in your yard if you do like a full on haunted house and all that.
I don't know. Maybe.
Some people really get into it.
I think it's a weekend.
Okay, nonetheless.
Yeah.
We want to remind our listeners and our listeners to remind those around them.
I don't want to. I don't know if I'm really thinking that the people who listen to us need a reminder.
I don't
this,
think they
like,
need a reminder. I think
I'm just, yeah, like, yo, when you get outside and you see somebody doing some racist nonsense with some costumes, let them know. You know? Like, I mean, like, straight up, if it's somebody who, if you're doing a costume where you have to put pigment on your skin in order to change your race, you need to stop it, okay? That's not okay. Real talk, you're probably putting on blackface. Stop doing that. You know about blackface. Everybody knows about blackface. If someone tells you that they don't know about blackface in the United States, they lying to you.
Right. And what about the when we see cultural heroes represented as costumes?
If it's a white person, it's fine. It's real talk. No one cares if you do George Washington.
I open up the dialogue about one particular theme that comes up a lot around Halloween is the representation of Frida Kahlo, a Mexican artist and activist. And her image is depicted consistently and represents, you know, a lot of empowerment for women, for Chicano women or for Latina women. Yet, I consistently see her represented as a Halloween costume by many, many parties.
I don't know. I mean,
I'm not going to do the Trump. I was going to do it. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to refrain.
Yeah, well, I don't. I've seen representations. I don't know. I feel like you got to be pretty thoughtful to come up with her as a costume. Like, I don't know. I've seen, the only people I've seen doing that are people of Latin descent, so Latinx folks, and I don't feel like I would tell them not to be somebody, like, it's like usually someone who's pushing, who wants to, like, celebrate feminist belief and, like, mm-hmm. she's a hero of theirs. And
right.
So, you know, like, if I let me put it a different way. If I was going to dress up like Barack Obama, right, I think I can dress up like a Barack Obama and that's fine because he's a hero of mine. Right, he's somebody who identify with, and there is no extra racial overtones that go along with that.
Mm-hmm.
But if a white guy was gonna do that, like, I mean, at least you better be ready for some questions, man. You know, and like, to be absolutely honest, you can do it if you do it by, like, and I think this is my thing about it. You should not have to make phenotypical traits different about yourself. In order to do it,
right.
You can put on the suit, you can put on the tie, you can have an America pin and like say like and speak in Barack Obama kind of, you know, like do the points and point with your thumb and, you know, change your voice and do the Barack Obama pause before you speak, you know. But if you put blackface on, right?
I think what I hear, and maybe I haven't quite thought about this, because Halloween typically is done in the spirit of kind of playfulness, of a little bit of mockery, And I think it is also, it creates an opportunity just in terms of being in costume for people to come represent a lot of different things. And so not everybody that dresses up in costume is doing that to make fun of the image that they're representing.
Right.
So is there room to represent those cultural icons for people that hold those identities or represent those to an authentic place? Sure. I would say yes, because we don't always get a chance to dress up, particularly as adults. So it doesn't always have to be in the vein of making fun or, you know, in mockery.
Right. But like I think it's one of those things where you know it when you see it and people know when they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this pretense that you don't know that you're if you're trying to be Nicki Minaj, and you put like pillows in your butt or something like that, that you're not making a caricature not only of her but of black women in general, right? Like that's what I think we're talking about when we talk about like really racist and culturally appropriative pieces. Like if you make a respectful adaptation of somebody who's within your kind of wheelhouse of people that would be heroes of yours, that's one thing, you know. But I think like for instance Frida, if you come at it from like this feminist idea and you do it tastefully, like I think that maybe that works, but she's not as charged as like a Harriet Tubman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's not as charged as like a Sojourner Truth. You know, like there are folks who it's like you just can't do that. You know, if you're a white person, you really just can't do that because there's so much subtext to it and so much fraught spaces that you're likely going to do harm even mm-hmm. if you don't want to. So is it more important for you to be free to like portray whoever you want and have your own personal freedom, or is it more important for you to be socially responsible? And you know, I tend to lean on socially responsible,
mm-hmm.
right? So, I mean, and I think that goes across cultures, too. Like, I'm not going to try to be, you know, I'm not going to try to be Maui from Polynesian, you know, mythology.
Moana.
Not Moana. Yeah, from Moana, but, like, mm-hmm. Maui as a god, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, that doesn't feel right,
mm-hmm.
you know? That's like a cherished piece of a person's culture, right? Why am I going to portray that? Do I have the same connection? Even though
mm-hmm.
I might like the movie and I might have heard something, I didn't earn that, you know? And I think that's the piece.
Well,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. And there are a lot of little girls that want to dress up as Moana this Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
And there's different conversations that are happening in certain spaces around, do you let your child, you know, represent this character? And in what way? And is it because they love them, or is it because it's the most popular? And
well, I think it changes when you're talking about little kids too.
Mm.
Like a little kid, I think a little kid can dress up like whoever they want to, as long as the parents are tasteful and they're doing it, right? If a little girl wants to be Moana, and they dress her in a way that like where like she puts on the Moana costume, and it's not like some sort of derogatory interpretation of Polynesian bodies and faces and skin and stuff like that, you know, then yeah, if a little boy wants to be Maui and he wants to have the like fake tattoos and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Or if the little boy wants to be Moana. And I think the last question I had around Halloween was, did you ever have like a favorite costume when you were a kid or anything?
No.
No?
No, I don't think, no. No, it's not like the dressing up has never been the most fun for me.
Mm-hmm.
It was the being out at night and like going around and ask for candy. I mean, that was more fun. That was like, so by the time I was like a teenager, I was like, I'll wear my football jersey and that's going to be my costume or something, you know, or I do my own stuff. It's, yeah, it depends.
Mm-hmm.
It depends. Actually, no, let me lie. I'm not going to. My favorite costume is not from when I was a kid. It's from when I was an adult. It was when I dressed up as Clark Kent. And so I had my wife actually, it was her idea, but I dressed up in like, you know, work clothes. And then I had the Superman S on a blue shirt under my button up shirt. And the reason I really loved that was because This was when a lot of conversation was happening about cultural appropriation and blackface and things like that. And I was walking around and everyone knew who I was. And I would point out, like, hey, you know exactly who I am. And I did not have to paint my face white.
Mm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my favorite costume. I even have a picture of it right there if you look.
You do.
Yeah.
You do.
So that was fun.
Bedford has a picture in his office.
I do have a picture in my office. It's taken by a friend of mine. Cool. So anyway.
Well, let's keep boogieing through the what's going on. What else boogie. We got?
We gonna boogie?
Yeah.
How are we gonna boogie the White Lives Matter?
I guess you're right about that. I was just trying to move us along, you know, bump us down the road a little bit.
Bump us down
the spreadsheet.
To white supremacy.
Can we get down a couple lines on the spreadsheet? We're going
to bump and bop down to the good old white supremacy. Here you go, folks. So in Tennessee, a whole bunch of racist people are getting together. And they're saying that they don't like immigrants and they don't like refugees and get out of my country. But we're not racist. We just think white lives matter. And there's a whole trending hashtag of ignorant ass people who are supporting that on Facebook and on Twitter and on other things. And I don't want to put too much time into it. I just wanted to point out to everyone that there's a bunch of stupid people in Tennessee doing a stupid thing. And there's a bunch of stupid people supporting them. And that's all I have to say about that.
All right.
Yeah, was that a clear?
That was good.
Yeah. So there you go. Do you got anything to say about them?
No, because I don't know much about it, and I don't know how I would react to it if I did see it. That's a good question, I think, for our listeners, though, and maybe we can call in some reflections from. You know, all of our listeners are like, how do you respond, you know, on Facebook or in conversations around, you know, racist rhetoric? And do you just ignore White Lives Matter or do you get in that conversation? And maybe for our white ally listeners, like, what's your role and what's your position on some of those pieces?
Well, I think that so we know that there's research that shows that you're not going to change someone's mind. When you try to argue with them online, you just don't. People mm-hmm. become more entrenched. My route is honestly one of the things that moves people to like stop doing stuff is guilt and shame. You know, so I think you shame people. I think you guilt people. You tell them like when someone tells you why can't white lives matter? I think you list out the reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like well, let's start with slavery. You know,
right.
Let's talk about genocide of Native populations. How about we talk about lynching or, a little thing they call redlining or, you know, colonialism, you know, just murdering people. That's kind of why. Yeah.
Guilt and shame.
I think that you have to bring reality. You know, you're not going to shift someone's belief set overnight, but you can stop them from spending a lot of time espousing it in one space or another. And I think that there's something to that. I don't like the idea. I don't think that hate speech should go unchallenged.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you on that.
You know, so, and I think that the best way to challenge is not to get an argument and not to try to mess with merit because it's a straw man. You know, they make up a fake narrative and they want you to go along with it. I'm not going to go along with that. You tell me why. I'm going to show you a picture of lynching. Argue with that. Argue with truth. Argue with race riots. You know, argue with Tamir Rice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I don't have much for it. That's why I didn't want to, like, as we brought it up, the reason I was so flippant is because I'm tired of giving these people, like, any kind of, it's not that I don't think they need to be watched and have attention placed on them, but they're not important people in terms of discourse. They're important in terms of them being dangerous. So the same way I want to give you a report that there's a riptide at the beach and that there was a fungal bloom that, like, makes the water toxic and that there's smoke in the air that you need to, like, keep your windows closed. Well, if you're out in Tennessee right now, there's a bunch of scary white people doing scary white people stuff. Maybe you should stay away from the area or go protest knowing that there's going to be trouble.
I hear you.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
All right. You're welcome.
So something that came up this past week, and I think folks have been wondering, and I know that different Congress folks have been calling for this since Trump was elected, is that a hedge fund manager, philanthropist, Tom Steyer, has recently donated about $10 million to fund a campaign for the impeachment of Donald Trump. Hmm.
So is he giving that money directly to Republican senators?
I don't, you know, in terms of where the money goes, that I don't know. He is based in California and has, from what I read briefly, you know, this presence in different issues around higher education, immigrant rights, climate change, healthcare, education, in some of his funding campaigns, et cetera, and has been a longtime supporter of the Democratic Party and different, you know, Clinton when she was running, and then also for Barack Obama. But I think for someone to, like, really put some money behind this issue and to, like, he's really the first one to really step into it, I think, formally with some of the funding, because I know that other people have called for it and have asked for it. But to have, you know, the presence of these commercials on different news cycles come up, this is the first.
Yeah. I mean, I hear that. I don't see much. So this is my, you know, I it's just not the way the system works. Like, this dude isn't going to get impeached by Republicans. Like, if we want to impeach Trump, if Trump is going to get impeached, it has to happen after we fill the Congress with Democrats. Like, we have to win elections, because Republicans aren't going to impeach a Republican president. They're just not going to do that. And it doesn't matter what ads are out there. They don't listen to the public. They just took the rights. Just this last week, they took our right to sue credit card companies and sue, like, banks away. They took that away. They ain't worrying about us. They are worried about them staying in office and whatever, like, kickbacks they're getting. So I hear what you're saying. I just think that, like, that hopefully when he's putting that money, he's putting that money into campaigns, and we all should be placing our energy into working to build and elect folks who mm-hmm. are going to take the spaces that Republicans are holding right now, because they aren't moral. They aren't worried about the continuance of our republic. They're worried about their own, like, capricious, selfish stuff. But that's just my thought.
I appreciate your thought.
Yeah. Thank you.
And it was nice to see the commercial. I was like, ooh, okay.
I hear that.
Some progress. Or so, some presence. Whatever you want to call it.
Speaking about progress and presence.
So, progress and presence around this issue around sexual harassment, sexual assault, and the stories and the legacy of survivors. So I'm certain many of our listeners have heard about one particular individual, and I would say that he's probably one of many, many, many in the media and in the public eye, but Harvey Weinstein, you know, coming not just under fire, but 60 women have come forward and accused him of inappropriate behavior ranging from, you know, inappropriate touching, inappropriate solicitation, all the way to rape. Mm. And really the unpacking, I think, of a legacy of folks in spaces that were around him that were aware of his behaviors and different responses and reactions that I think that many people in the public eye are having around feeling, recognizing that they didn't necessarily take responsibility or take action that could have been supportive of these victims.
Yeah. So they were basically being regular people.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what regular people do. That's what everybody has been doing for a really long time, right? Is that we see the constant harassment and assault and just general, like, misogynistic interactions with women, and we don't do very much about it.
Right.
I wonder, though, I've been watching this, and I'm, like, looking at, like, the backlash, and I'm wondering kind of, you know, I always come to the space of, like, trying to think about you know, what's going to come of this?
Oh, it'll be interesting to see, you know, because I think often I read something or heard something. It's like, well, non-disclosure is typically utilized to protect both, you know, parties on both sides so that there's no further slander, so that the issue doesn't continue to like come out in the public in those ways. But really the impact I think that people are really acknowledging is that it has silenced folks in a way that has allowed for the further demonstration of these inappropriate behaviors to continue.
I mean, there's something to be said about, like, you know, should we allow, because, you know, when someone has, if someone is accused of domestic violence, right, like, they're not, the person who's being perpetrated against isn't the arbiter of whether that person's going to be convicted or indicted or any of that stuff, mm-hmm. right? And I believe that the justification for that is that it's a public safety issue, right? And it's not the person against the perpetrator, it's the city or the state or whatever, right? Like, it's the state of California against so-and-so, or mm-hmm. city of mm-hmm. Los Angeles against so-and-so. In these cases where they get settled in civil cases, I wonder whether there's an argument to be made about, like, the idea that, you know, there's a safety issue that Absolutely. Has to be mm-hmm. accounted for. And when someone settles mm-hmm. for this, maybe it's like you as the person who's accusing them maybe can't talk about it anymore because you settled and you got paid and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. But maybe it's one of those things that needs to be in record so that it should be triggered in some way. So, like, right. you know, this goes into the record and this shall automatically open up if someone else makes an accusation,
right?
You know, so that it's something that you can't make it into these one allegation situations, you know?
Right. And that, I think, can we move? Because that leads, yeah. I think, directly into the next point around, you know, Betsy DeVos and her ending the Obama era guidelines on campus sexual assault.
You want to talk about that? Give some more context on that?
Sure. So, and I don't know the specifics, but, you know, President Obama enacted, I think, a Dear Colleague letter that was used to address and encourage college campuses to be more thorough, timely, and I think critical of the issues of sexual assault on college campuses, because a lot of issues were going underreported, unreported, or unresolved for many, many moons. And so this effort and attempt created more attention and energy around sexual assault on college campuses. And I would say that there was also a lot of student activism around this issue. So, you know, in this past couple of years, you know, particularly here in California, we've seen many, many student demonstrations, students walking around campuses with mattresses, with tape over their mouth, really giving power to the issues of sexual assault and really putting themselves out there to say that this is not being handled appropriately. And more recently, you know, with the changes of the administration, Betsy DeVos has undone those efforts in a lot of ways. And I think that, as you had mentioned, and I just want to highlight around the piece around, like, the public health issue, is that in certain spaces, you know, there, and this, I think, comes from my own background of working at different colleges, and I'm not trying to say that this is, like, the majority of experiences, but, you know, part of the challenge of really having a responsibility towards safety in an environment is really, really important. So anytime that there is, like, this threat to safety, whether it's, you know, an active shooter or not having certain things in college campus spaces, sexual assault is one of those things. I think it goes along those certain lines because of the predatory behaviors of some individuals can wreak havoc on an entire campus community.
Well, many individuals mm-hmm. and many groups, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, just to put it out there, the reason that President Obama had to affect changes to Title IX in terms of, like, the way that we approach it is because colleges and universities have not been good. They have not been good actors in dealing with sexual assault and rape on campuses. In many cases, before the Obama guidelines came in, folks were, you know, women and other folks who were victimized or who were assaulted or raped were not getting the justice that they deserved. In fact, a lot of universities were trying to keep things internal. So mm-hmm. someone would commit an actual crime and it wouldn't be reported to police. Mm-hmm. Right. So rape isn't something that is a it's not a student handbook issue. Mm-hmm. Rape is a criminal code issue. Right. But colleges and universities weren't actually reporting what they needed to report. And they weren't keeping evidence the way they were supposed to. They weren't bringing people in when they should bring them in. So, like, what happens when the university takes 3 days to report to the police, even though the student reported to the university immediately? Mm-hmm. You know, what happens to the crime scene? What happens to the stories of people? What happens to the pressure that can be brought to bear? So the idea was, and if you're a university, if you're a member of the university, an employee of the university, there was a new interpretation of Title IX that said that basically everyone's a mandated reporter, mm-hmm. right? That means that if, as a professor, you come up to me and tell me about, or if I hear anything about a sexual assault on campus, I have to report that to our Title IX officer, and it's not a question. Like, right. And that's different than prior to that, where there could be cover-ups. Mm-hmm. It's the same reasoning and rationale for why there's mandated reporting of child abuse. Because if you don't mandate that reporting, people can come up with all kinds of reasons why they're not going to disrupt mm-hmm. families and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I think that these rollbacks in regulation and rollback in protections, they leave people in a space where they can be victimized much easier.
Right. And so what we know from research is that 1 in 5 undergraduates has experienced sexual violence, and how catastrophic and disruptive it is for their entire life, from, you know, their own emotional capacity, how they're moving through the world, their sense of safety moving through the world, and then, you know, academic performance as well in education, and how it can be cumulative and just continue to be a thread that they carry with them for a very, very long time.
And forever, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be a trauma. Mm-hmm. You know, now I'm speaking from, a very clinical perspective. But, like, we talk about trauma in terms of anything bad that happens. But, like, from a very clinical perspective, from a diagnostic perspective, when we're talking about actual diagnoses of trauma, we're talking about something happens that's so horrible that you basically re-experience that over and over again, so that you have the past event is not distinguishable from current life, right? And that's what that can happen when someone is raped or when they have a sexual assault. So there's, like, all these mental health and these, like, physical health and these social and economic, and there's all these consequences of women and other folks who are also victimized or assaulted, that they have to deal with. It's like a tax mm-hmm. that folks who've never been assaulted don't have to deal with, right. You know? I think it's also important to kind of point out that the people who are most vulnerable, the demographic group, is people who are in the LGBTQIA plus communities. Mm-hmm. Those are the folks who are the most vulnerable to sexual assault on campuses. Mm-hmm. And so when we think about that, then it is an issue that deeply impacts women, but there's other groups that are part of that, mm-hmm. you know, including men.
Right.
You know, so mm-hmm. the thing that we also need to point out when we say that is the perpetrators are usually men, right? But it's not always.
Right. And it just connected to, I think that there's just a lot of stuff swirling in the media and different conversations, and it just pinged directly to this article that I recently saw in the New York Times that is titled, "Willing to Do Everything, Mothers Defend Sons Accused of Sexual Assault." And there were so many interesting and troubling things that came out in this article for me. And I don't know if folks can resonate. Like, if you ever just, like, you can't get through a sentence without, like, making some motion or, like, breathing heavily or, like, you know, being exasperated, you know, in a visible way. And every time I read just one sentence of this article, it just activated me so, so much. So can I read a little bit of the article?
Yeah.
For the listeners?
Yeah.
All right. And always in the spirit of, like, really want for y'all to come into the conversation, the dialogue. So let us know what you think. But So the article is speaking to the experience of these four mothers, and visually in, and this is, I think, of something to note, that visually in the article, there's a picture of them maybe at a restaurant or a coffee shop, and they all appear to be white. And I think that that's an important piece, because something that comes up in the article is around this conversation and the presentation of their efforts, not just as parents, but also maximizing their resources to advocate for their sons. And so it's things like, you know, away from the public eye, talking about the family spending tens of thousands of dollars, dipping into their retirement accounts, leveraging their public relationships to assuage the university leadership to change or to undo some of the consequences. And I just, the privilege that came up when I was reading this article is just like, I think I was knocked over.
Well, it's not just privilege, it's entitlement, right? It's like, we're speaking to like straight up class and race privilege, like white privilege and class privilege, and and using it to support male privilege.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So, I mean, like, yeah, it's, I think that one of the things to talk about, and maybe this is where we go into real talk. So, real talk.
Real talk.
Let's talk about what it means to be a person within a group, right? Who supports folks who oppress your group. Right? It's almost like the anti-ally.
The anti-ally. Real talk, the anti-ally. So connected to that, there was something in the article that I want to read. And one of the moms said that in my generation, what these girls are going through was never considered assault. It was considered, and I quote, "I was stupid and I got embarrassed." So to hear this mom really reflect on their own or known lived experiences of sexual assault, trauma and rape, and or those around them, and to say that, you know what, the culture back then was that it just wasn't that big of a deal and we never made a big deal about it.
I mean, that's not true, though. She's lying, right? Because people were talking about rape then, too. Hmm. Right? So I think that one of the things that really bugged me about reading this was this idea that they also talk about how they're going to leverage the fact that they're women in order to like speak to this cause, this pro male cause thing that they're doing. For me, I listen to that the same as like black folks who want to be in White Lives Matter groups and stuff like that. You know, it's like there's an anti-self piece to it, an idea that, you know, somehow I need to benefit this group that doesn't have my best interest in mind. And maybe they are trying to protect their sons, but maybe their sons wouldn't be out there doing stuff like that if they weren't the people that they are, you know?
So, yeah, utilizing their presence as mothers and as women to further support misogyny and male privilege.
Yeah. I mean, It's a really nasty thing, but it's always been that way in terms of like who's gonna be put in front. I wonder about this whole article. Like, why would it even be published? You know, like, because they're using anecdotes, right? They're saying like, well, this one case here happened and this one case here happened, but statistically, we know that it's not just one case, and that it's not just one group of people. It's an overarching, like, national and international problem.
Right.
Right? So your little Tommy and Jimmy and whatever having their feelings hurt because they did something inappropriate and got called on it, you know, I'm not here for you. In fact, I'm so not here from you. Like, I want you to go away and shut up and take them with you. And I hope they get in trouble. Like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, if your kid raped somebody,
your kid raped somebody. I was really surprised that this article was published. So while people really want to uphold that culture of sexual violence, assault, misogyny, I think that there is another wave of the culture shift happening when you have the people coming out, talking about their lived experiences and the re-emerging of a campaign of Me Too.
Well, so I don't know if I would say re-emerging.
I think it's I'm trying to say it's re-emerging because it was appropriated. So I don't want to say the creation.
It was appropriated.
Okay. Get into it.
White people stole it from black people. Like, they do a lot of stuff.
All right. So, y'all, if you don't know that I even saw this on Good Morning America, that Alyssa Milano came on Good Morning America talking about the hashtag Me Too campaign and was very tearful and really expressing support for victims of sexual assault and sexual violence. And I think what that moment in Good Morning America and what moments on social media have failed to acknowledge is that a black woman, Tarana Burke, was the original creator of the Me Too campaign in her work with the nonprofit agency and as a counselor and victims rights advocate. And so this Huffington Post article really highlighted the issue, and it said that, in quote, that the Me Too movement highlights a common problem, that feminist movements are often whitewashed when they are brought into mainstream conversations. Women of color are often overlooked and left out of the very conversations they create.
Yeah. I think that's the whole basis of the womanist movement, right?
Mm-hmm. So, and you want to say more about that? That the womanist movement as in opposition to feminism. So womanism as being highlighting the voices of women of color and black women and black queer feminist theory, moving against the tradition of feminism that was historically in isolation of white voices.
Yeah, I think you kind of covered it.
Okay, so did I get it right there?
Yeah, and I don't know that I'm the right person to, like, put it out there. Right?
I'm not an expert either.
Yeah, but, I mean, I feel like, you know, it's... I jive well. I mean, like, I have to be honest. Like, as a black man, I have a hard time with, like, feminist thought because it's really starkly white and if there's not space for black women in that, there's definitely no space for black men. Mm-hmm. But from a womanist perspective, like, that was always a place where I was able to kind of find a place where I might be able to be an ally, where I might be able to work with folks. Because from a woman's perspective, I'm not this, like, you know, brutish, evil black dude, right? Which, I'm sorry, the white side
yes.
Of any kind of white movement is going to always cast me as this, like, monster.
Right. And I so appreciate you bringing that in, because that is it's the power of the stereotype and the creation of these conversations around the fear of rape and misogyny. And what was that original movie? It was
the Birth of a Nation.
The Birth of a Nation, right? Yeah. And Birth of a Nation being this very, you know, early 1900s. Maybe it was in the 1800s, like
1900s.
Yeah. Motion picture without just, you know, with the sound. There wasn't any, like, voiceover of this white woman being terrified and fleeing against this alleged black faced man. And she was so terrified that she jumped off of a cliff.
Right. Well, I mean, like, that's part of, see, and this is where we start talking about, like, certain intersectional problems that we don't talk about very much. Right. Whiteness, one of the, like, underlying pieces about whiteness is its relationship to blackness, and one of the main kind of relational interactions that repeat over and over is the idea that black men are oversexed rapists, mm-hmm. who are going to, like, come in and do bad things to white women, which justifies the murder and lynching and the oppression of black men and, mm-hmm. in extension, black women.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that specifically, like, the relationship is white men to black men in specific ways, because from a white male perspective, right, a white supremacist perspective, they also marginalize women.
Right.
Right. So they use women, the white women, as a lever,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then they use black women as, like, you know, just for their bodies. I mean, it's horrible. I don't know. This feels like it's going out to the woods.
I appreciate it, though, Bedford. Honestly, I really do, because I think you can't go from talking about this hashtag Me Too and the whitewashing of it without then evoking the conversations of rape and sexual assault that are historically stereotyped in our minds in such a way that it immediately triggers. Just like if you say other inappropriate sort of, like, comments, right, that you immediately get the image of a black man. You immediately do. And I think that what hopefully what these conversations will start to do, particularly around the Me Too campaign and some other issues around the presence of sexual assault in certain spaces, is the use of power as that leverage and that tool. And who are those in positions of power and authority oftentimes? Oftentimes, yes, men, but this presence of white men in these different spaces, right? And so repackaging the narrative of what does sexual assault and rape look like, right? And I think that image is core to that historical narrative. And I think in these conversations, I think it is appropriate for us to bring that in and to call that in as we are trying to elevate the lived experiences of all of these individuals and saying that in this Me Too campaign, how do we create space for voices of those that are the most marginalized? And that would be trans women of color, right? Who are those that are most at risk of that violence, of that sexual violence? Trans women of color. How do we create space for those in the LGBT community? How do we create space for men in those conversations that are victims of sexual assault and sexual violence and trauma? I think we do that together. So I think it's all relevant.
All right. I think you named it.
Cool.
So, all right. So I guess now it's time for takeaways.
Our takeaways.
Yeah. So today for a takeaway, I think one of the things is about just active listening, like being able to be to build your allyship through listening to what's actually happening to folks and like building your awareness of how you're involved, right? Mm-hmm. So as a man, when I see the hashtag Me Too and watch the stories pop up on my timelines and on my Twitter feeds and when I hear it coming from my wife and from my colleagues, mm-hmm. It's very easy to take on the stance of, well, that wasn't me, right? I'm not like that. She's talking about all the other guys. No, sorry, y'all. If you're really trying to be an ally to women and an ally to marginalized groups and an ally to folks who are assaulted, you have to put yourself into it. The same way as every white person out there, when you're trying to be an anti-racist activist, you got to know that you're racist. And you got to know that you're working on it, and you got to know to push yourself. Mm-hmm. Well, men, you need to know that you're a misogynist and you're sexist, and you need to work on what you're doing. And if you're going to be honest with yourself, you know you've enacted some of this stuff,
mm-hmm.
right? You may not, you know, it may not have gone as far as grabbing somebody or gone as far as physically, like, assaulting someone. But you're going to tell me that you haven't said something out of pocket to a woman, then I'm going to call you a liar. And that's just true. And you know, if it wasn't such, I'll just put it this way. There's more women in the United States than men. Okay, straight up. More women in the United States than men. How is it that they so frequently get abused if it ain't a whole lot of us doing it? Or do you just think it's like 10% of us running around to every city, taking shifts, yelling and catcalling and doing all that stuff? That's not what's happening. All of us engaging it for different reasons at different times and for different like really stupid, nasty kind of reasons, mm-hmm. right?
And I think that the part of it for me is also allowing people to create space for their awareness raising. And when they have those aha moments, or they're like, oh, yeah, like I didn't realize that, you know, when I was doing that thing, that was an abuse of power or me leveraging, you know, my power in that way, in that moment. I didn't see it as that way, you know, or whatever the case may be. It could be something subtle, I guess. I'm saying it because I think and we had talked about this earlier about threshold, right?
Yeah.
And the threshold for nonsense, particularly around misogyny, inappropriate sexual behavior, sexual assault, et cetera, is high. And because the threshold is high, you have a whole lot of people, irregardless of gender or gender identity, believing in these values and these principles that are saying, oh, that wasn't that big of a deal. And let's go ahead and lower that threshold and for everyone to say, oh, yeah, you know what? When that happened to me, that was inappropriate. And here were some of the dynamics and here's where power and privilege showed up in these different ways, and to create the opportunity for people to reflect on that and to share that alongside.
Yeah. I guess, and we talked about this whole threshold thing. Like, I think that people know when they're doing wrong. And you know because someone looked at you and they give you, people give you feedback. You know, like, you're not just like gonna unconsciously move through this world. And if we're talking about actual assault, like, yo, straight up, if you put your hands on somebody and grabbed them, like, you were on the, if you went to the club and you pulled some girl onto the dance floor who didn't want to get pulled on the dance floor, you assaulted her, right? If you went,
that's what I'm talking about, Bedford.
I'm just saying, if you grab somebody, if you touch somebody who doesn't want to be a touch, that's assault. If there's a sexual nature to it, then it's a sexual assault. And there is no middle ground there. And I think that men need to understand that there is no middle ground there. People, everyone needs to understand that. When you're on the street, if you say something rude based on sexuality, if you say something rude based on your sexual intents, so like basically you want to holler at somebody, they don't want to holler back, so now you're going to say something crazy to them, yo, that's not okay. You know, that's borderline assault. That's definitely catcalling. You know, and it depends on how far you go with it. Mm-hmm. Did you menace this person? Did you make her afraid of you mm-hmm. based on what she said because you had your feelings hurt? Well, you know what? Stay inside. Don't go outside no more, man. Like, you don't put that on other people. Like, no one needs to respond to your holler. You know?
Right.
The world just ain't that into you. Just let it go. I what I'm saying is that we have to think about these things we've done.
Right.
Like, every man out there, whether you call yourself a good guy or not a good guy, there was a moment, maybe you were in college, maybe you were in high school, maybe it was yesterday. Mm-hmm. You were out and you said something crazy to somebody that you shouldn't have said, or you touched somebody you shouldn't have touched, or you looked at somebody you shouldn't have looked at and put your gaze on somebody in a way that, and I that's the one that we haven't talked about, staring at people. You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? Like, there's power in how you look at someone. And you're not going to tell anyone that pretty people will not get looks. Fine. But your look don't have to linger, homie. It takes about half a second to move your eyes past someone. You get your image, you move the hell on, but when you sitting here staring at somebody like some sort of creep, I'm sorry, dude. Like, that's you. You're doing that. It's not okay. Stop it.
He said your look don't have to linger.
It doesn't.
I appreciate you, Bedford.
I'm just saying.
I think these are the subtleties that I think that people need to raise their awareness to. Like, oh, yeah. Like, you know, it doesn't have to be these most egregious, heinous behaviors that are agreed upon. Right. Like, you know, rape and et cetera. There are other behaviors that fall into these same categories of assault and of, like you said, menacing, different mm-hmm. types of stalking behaviors. Those things need to be incorporated into our collective awareness of inappropriate and not acceptable.
Yeah. Quit being jerks. Quit being dangerous. Quit being horrible people. As I've learned the millennials say it, quit being trash. Okay? Because I'm tired of hearing about how men are trash. It feels horrible to hear that. But then it feels even worse to realize, yes, we are trash. Because we do trash stuff. So quit being trash, y'all. I don't like it. I don't like having it. I don't want it no more. I'd like to at least be like, men are okay. Men are nice, but that can't be true until we actually are. So until we stop being trash, you know what? I'm just sorry, y'all. That's, I mean, I'm learning this millennial lingo. When I was older, we didn't say, I don't know, like, but that's what they're saying about us. All you men out there, that's what they're saying about us, and it's justified. Deal with it. If you want to make it better, make it better. That's the takeaway for today.
That's the takeaway. So, for details about topics mentioned in this episode, check out our website, nameitpodcast.com, and subscribe for our newsletter, because we've been putting together these jamming newsletters that have all of our content, all of the different articles, different pictures and different images and write-ups. So join the newsletter, sign up for that. You can get it on nameitpodcast.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at nameitpodcast.
And you can check out our store, pick up some Naming It gear. We haven't had anything new on there for a while, but the old stuff is still cool. And if you have some requests, like some ideas for how we can like make some hot gear, then let us know.
And for individual social media, you can find me on Twitter at Lamisha Hill. And where are you at?
I'm at DRBF Palmer. And if you like what you heard, leave us a review.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying? Like, we have 30 reviews right now, and I always check. I check all the time, y'all. And I just need us to have more reviews.
Man, if you reacted to this hashtag quit being trash and you feel some type of way about it, and if something that we talked about today resonates with you, we really want to hear about it. So write it up in a review. Let us know.
As long as it's 5-star. If you mad at me for the trash thing, hit me up at Dr. B.F. Palmer. Tell me about that. Don't be messing with our stars on those. Yo, you know who you are, man. I'm talking to you. Just keep it. We can have a conversation. Don't mess with the stars.
All right. Don't mess with the stars. But we do want to hear from you. We want to be in dialogue with you, in conversation with you. So please let us know. And as always, we want to say what up to Music on Naming It, provided by Lee England Jr. You can check him out on social media at Lee England Jr.
All right. So that's it for today.
That's it, y'all. Keep naming it.
Peace.